hands into fists. The vampire let out a short, stunned, gasping sound and rocked beneath the blow. She slid out of the chair to her knees, feebly trying to move away from Murphy. Murph wasn't having any of it. She grabbed Felicia by the hair, hauled her halfway to her feet, and then, with a furious shout and a contraction of her whole body, Murphy slammed the vampire's face down onto the coffee table. Felicia's head shattered the teapot and the platter beneath, and struck the oak table with such force that a crack erupted from end to end in the wood. Murphy slammed Felicia's head down with near equal violence two more times. Then she turned and dragged Felicia over to the front door of her house by the hair. Murphy let her go with a contemptuous shove, stood over her, and pointed the gun at the vampire's head.
"This is what happens," Murphy said in a very quiet, hard voice. "You leave here alive. You keep your fucking mouth shut. And we never mention tonight ever again. If the White Court even blinks in the sword's direction, I am going to come find you, Felicia. Whatever happens to me in the end, before I am taken, I will find you." Felicia stared up at her, wobbling and shaking, clearly dazed. Murphy had broken the vampire's nose and knocked out at least two teeth. One of Felicia's high cheekbones was already swelling. The broken teapot had left multiple cuts on her face, and her skin had been scalded by the hot liquid still inside. Murphy leaned a little closer and put the barrel of the gun against Felicia's forehead. Then she whispered, very quietly, "Bang." The vampire shuddered.
"Do what you think best, Felicia,"
Murph whispered. Then she straightened again slowly and spoke in a clear, calm voice as she walked back to her chair.
"Now, get out of my house."
Felicia managed to stagger to her feet, open the front door, and limp haltingly to the white limousine idling on the snowy street outside the house. Murphy went to the window to watch Felicia get into the limo and depart.
"Yeah," I said deadpan, "the little blonde woman has two of them."
"Oh, my," Sir Stuart said, his voice muted with respect.
"I can see why you come to her for assistance."
"Damn skippy," I agreed. "Better go get Morty, while she's still in a good mood."
Chapter 10
I met Morty and Sir Stuart on Murphy's front porch. I guess it was a cold night. Morty stood with his entire body hunched against the wind, his hands stuffed into his coat pockets. His eyes darted around nervously. He was shivering.
"Hit the bell," I said.
"And this is just my opinion, but if I were you, I'd keep my hands in plain sight."
"Thanks," Morty said sourly, jabbing the doorbell. "Have I told you how much brightness you bring to my world whenever you show up in it, Dresden?"
"All in a day's work when you've created from the cosmic legends of the universe," I replied.
"Be advised," Sir Stuart said, "that there are wolves to the left and right."
I looked. He was right. One was huge and dark-furred, the other smaller and lighter brown. They were sitting in the shadows, perfectly still, where a casual glance would simply pass over them. Their wary stares were intense.
"Will and Marcy," I said. "They're cool."
"They're violent vigilantes," Mort replied through clenched teeth.
"Buck up, little camper. They're not going to hurt you, and you know it."
Mort gave me a narrow-eyed glare, and then Murphy opened the door.
"Miss Murphy," Morty said, nodding to her.
"Lindquist, isn't it?" Murph asked.
"The medium?"
"Yes."
"What do you want?"
"Behind us," Sir Stuart murmured. I checked. A slender male figure in heavy winter clothing was crossing the street toward us. A third wolf, this one's fur edged with auburn, walked beside him.
"I'm here to speak to you on behalf of someone you knew," Mort told Murphy.
Murphy's blue eyes became chips of glacial ice.
"Who?"
"Harry Dresden," Mort said.
Murphy clenched her right hand into a fist. Her knuckles made small popping sounds. Mort swallowed and took half a step back.
"Look, I don't want to be here," he said, raising his hands and displaying his palms.
But you know how he was. His shade is no less stubborn or annoying than Dresden was in life.
You're a goddamn liar, Murphy snarled. You're a known con artist, and you are playing with fire.
Mort stared at her for a long moment, then he winced and said,
You believed he was still alive?
He is alive, Murphy replied, clenching her jaw. They never found a body.
Mort looked down, pressing his lips together, and ran his palm over his bald pate, smearing away a few clinging snowflakes. He blew out a long breath and said,
I'm sorry. I'm sorry that this is difficult.
It isn't difficult, Murphy replied, just annoying, because he's still alive.
Mort looked at me and spread his hands.
She's still in denial. There's not much I can do here. Look, I've done this a lot. She needs more time.
No, I said. We've got to make her see, tonight.
Mort pinched the bridge of his nose between his thumb and forefinger.
It isn't like you're getting any older, Dresden.
Murphy fixed Morty with her cop glare. It hadn't lost any of its intensity.
This is neither believable nor amusing, Lindquist. I think you'd better go now.
Lindquist nodded, holding up his hands in a gesture of placation.
I know, I'm going. Please understand, I'm just trying to help.
Wait, I snapped. There's got to be something you can say.
Mort glanced at me as he began walking back toward his car and lifted both of his hands, palms up, in a little helpless gesture. I ground my teeth, standing less than a foot away from Murphy. How the hell did I get her to believe it really was me? By having Morty talk about something only you could know, dummy, I said to myself. Morty! He paused about halfway down the driveway and turned to look at me. Ask her this, I said, and spouted a question. Mort sighed, then he turned toward Murphy and said,
Before I go, Dresden wants me to ask you if you ever found that reasonably healthy male.
Murphy didn't move. Her face went white. After maybe a minute, she whispered, What did you say?
I prompted Mort. Dresden wants me to tell you that he hadn't intended to do anything dramatic. It just sort of worked out that way. The wolves and the man in the heavy coat had stepped closer, listening.
Murphy clenched and unclenched her fist several times, and she said,
How many vampires did Agent White and I have to kill before we escaped the FBI office last year?
I felt another surge of fierce triumph. That was Murph, always thinking. I told Mort the answer.
He says he doesn't know who Agent White is, but that you and Tilly took out one of them in a stairwell on your way out of the building.
Mort tilted his head, listening to me, and then said, And he also wonders if you still feel that taking up the Sword of Faith would represent a rebound career.
Murphy's face by now was almost entirely bloodless. I could almost visibly see her eyes becoming more sunken, her features overtaken by a gray and weary sagging. She leaned against the doorway to her house, her arms sliding across her own stomach, as if she were trying to prevent her innards from spilling out.
Ms. Murphy, Mort said gently, I'm terribly sorry to be the one to bear this particular news, but Dresden's shade says that he needs to talk to you, that people are in danger.
Yeah, Murphy said, her voice numb. That's new.
She looked up at Mort and said, Bleed for me.
It was a common test among those savvy to the supernatural world but lacking any of its gifts. There are a lot of inhuman things that can pretend to be human, but relatively few of them have natural-looking blood. It wasn't a perfect test by any means, but it was a lot better than nothing. Mort nodded calmly and produced a straight pin from his coat pocket. He hadn't even blinked at the request. Apparently, in the current climate, the test had become much more widely used. I wondered if Murphy had been responsible for it. Morty pricked the tip of his left thumb with the pin, and it welled up with a round drop of ruby blood. He showed it to Murphy, who nodded.
It's cold out here. You'd better come inside, Mr. Lindquist.
Thank you,
Mort said with a heavy exhalation.
Meeting time, kids, Murphy said to those outside. I want this joker verified. Will, please send someone to invite Raggedy Ann over.
I don't want to be any trouble, Mort began.
Murphy gave him a chilly smile.
Get your ass inside and sit down. I'll tell you when you can go. And if you really are putting one over on us somehow, you should know that I am not going to be a good sport about it.
Mort swallowed, but he went inside. Murphy, Will, and Father Forthill spent the next half hour grilling Morty, and by extension me, with Abby and Daniel looking on. Each of them asked a lot of questions, mostly about private conversations I'd had with them. Morty had to relay my answers.
No, Father, I just had never heard a priest use the phrase screw the pooch before. Will, look, I offered to pay for that the door's ajar thing.
The chlorophene?
You killed it with a chainsaw, Murph.
And so on and so forth, until my blood, or maybe ectoplasm, was practically boiling.
This is getting ridiculous, I snapped finally. You're stalling. Why?
Morty blinked at me in surprise. Sir Stuart burst out in a short bark of laughter from where he lounged against a wall in the corner. Murphy looked at Mort closely, frowning.
What is it?
Dresden's getting impatient,
Mort said, his tone of voice suggesting that it was something grossly inappropriate, if not outright impolite.
He suspects that you're stalling and wants to know why. I'm sorry. Spirits are almost never this...
Stubbornly willful, Murphy suggested.
Insistent, Mort finished, his expression neutral.
Murphy sat back in her chair and traded a look with Father Forthill.
Well, she said, that sounds a great deal like Dresden, doesn't it?
I'm quite sure that only Dresden knew several of those details he mentioned in passing, Forthill said gravely. There are beings who could know such things, regardless of whether or not they were actually present, however. Very, very dangerous beings. Murphy looked at Mort and nodded.
So, either he's both sincere and correct in that Dresden's shade is there with him, or someone's been bamboozled and I've let something epic and nasty into my house.
Essentially, Forthill agreed with a small, tired smile. For whatever it's worth, I sense no dark presence here, just a draft.
That's Dresden's shade, Father, Mort said respectfully.
Mort, a good Catholic boy, who knew?
Where is Dresden now?
Murphy asked. She didn't exactly sound enthusiastic about the question. Mort looked at me and sighed.
He's sort of looming over you, a little to your left, Ms. Murphy. He's got his arms crossed and he's tapping one foot, and he's looking at his left wrist every few seconds, even though he doesn't wear a watch.
Do you have to make me sound so childish? I complained.
Murphy snorted.
That sounds like him.
Hey,
I said. There was a familiar soft pattering of paws on the floor, and Mister sprinted into the room. He went right across Murphy's hardwood floors and cannonballed into my shins. Mister is a lot of cat, checking in at right around 30 pounds. The impact staggered me, and I rocked back, and then quickly leaned down to run my hand over the cat's fur. He felt like he always did, and his rumbling purr was loud and happy. It took me a second to realize that I could touch Mister. I could feel the softness of his fur and the warmth of his body. More to the point, a large cat moving at a full run over a smooth hardwood floor had shoulder-blocked empty air and had come to a complete halt doing it. Everyone was staring at Mister with their mouths open. I mean, it's one thing to know that the supernatural world exists, and to interact with it on occasion in dark and spooky settings. But the weird factor of the supernatural hits you hardest at home, when you see it in simple, everyday things. A door standing open that shouldn't be, a shadow on the floor with no source to cast it, a cat purring and rubbing up against a favorite person who isn't there.
Oh,
Murphy said, staring, her eyes welling up. Will let out a low whistle. Father Forthill crossed himself, a small smile lifting the corners of his mouth.
Mort looked at the cat and sighed.
Oh, sure. Professional ectomancer with a national reputation as a medium tells you what's going on, and nobody believes him. But let a stump-tailed furry critter come in, and everyone goes all lifetime.
Heh, said Sir Stuart, quietly amused. What did I tell you? Cats.
Murphy turned to me, lifting her face toward mine. Her eyes were a little off, focused to one side of my face. I moved until I stood where she was looking, her blue eyes intent.
Harry?
I'm here, I said.
God, I feel stupid, Murphy muttered, looking at Mort.
He can hear me, right?
And see you, Mort said.
She nodded and looked up again, at a slightly different place. I moved again.
I know. It wouldn't matter to her.
But it mattered to me.
Harry, she said. A lot of things have happened since the last time we talked. The big spell at Chichen Itza didn't just destroy the Red Court who were there. It killed them all. Every Red Court vampire in the world.
Yeah, I said, and my voice sounded hard, even to me. That was the idea. Murphy blew out a breath.
Butters says that maybe there were some it missed, but they would have had to have been the very youngest and least powerful members of the least powerful bloodlines, or else sheltered away in some kind of protected location. But he says according to what he knows of magical theory, it makes sense.
I shrugged and nodded.
Yeah, I guess so. A lot depends on exactly how that rite was set up to work.
But the Red Court was dead, the same way the Black Court was dead. Life would go on. They were footnotes now.
When the Red Court fell, Murphy continued, their territory was suddenly open. There was a power vacuum. Do you understand?
Oh, God. assuming I would ever sleep again, which seemed to be a real question.
But I hadn't thought past that single moment, thought through the long-term consequences of wiping out the entire Red Court. They were one of the major supernatural nations in the world. They controlled a continent and change, South and most of Central America, and had holdings all over the world. They owned property, stocks, corporations, accounts. They as much as owned some governments, assets of every kind. The value of what the Red Court had controlled was almost literally incalculable. And I had thrown it all up in the air and declared one giant game of finders keepers.
Oops, I said.
Things are bad, Murphy said. Not so much here in Chicago. We've repulsed the worst incursions, mostly from some gang of arrogant freaks called the Fomor. And the Paranet has been a huge help. It's saved literally hundreds, if not thousands, of lives. In my peripheral vision, I saw Abby's spine straighten, and her eyes flash with a strength and surety I had never seen in her before. South America has the worst of it by a long ways, Murphy said. But every two-bit power and second-rate organization in the supernatural world sees a chance to found an empire. Old grudges and jealousies are getting dusted off. Things are killing one another as well as mortals all over the world. When one big fish shifts its power base to South America, dozens of little fish left behind try to grow enough to fill the space. So there's fighting everywhere. The White Council, I hear, is running its tubby ass off trying to hold things together and minimize the impact on regular folks. But we haven't seen them here, apart from a couple of times when Warden Ramirez came by, hunting for Molly.
Molly, I said, how is she?
I dimly heard Mort relaying my words. I noted that he was doing a credible job of mirroring my tone of voice. I guess he really had done a lot of this kind of thing before. She's still recovering from the wounds she took at Chichen Itza, Murphy said. She says they were as much psychic as physical, and that hit to her leg was pretty bad. I don't understand how your disappearance makes her a criminal to the White Council, but apparently it has.
Ramirez has told us that the wardens are looking to pass sentence on her, but he didn't seem to be working his ass off to find her, either. I know what it looks like when a cop is slacking.
How is she? I asked again. Murph, it's me. How's she doing?
She looked down and swallowed.
She isn't right, Harry.
What do you mean? Murphy looked up at me again, her jaw set.
She talks to herself.
She sees things that aren't there. She has headaches. She babbles.
Sounds like me, I said, at approximately the same time Will said, Sounds like Harry.
This is different, Murphy said to Will, and you know it. Dresden was in control of it. He used the weirdness to make him stronger. Were you ever afraid of him? Murphy asked. Outright afraid? Will frowned and looked down at his hands.
He could be scary.
But no, I never thought he'd hurt me, by accident or otherwise. How do you feel about Molly coming over? Murphy asked.
I would like to leave, Will replied frankly. The girl ain't right.
Apparently, Murphy continued, turning back to me, the presence of a wizard in a city, any city, all around the world, is an enormous deterrent. Weird things are afraid of the Council. They know that the White Council can come get you fast out of nowhere with overwhelming force. Most of the scary bad things around, the ones with any brains at least, avoid White Council territory.
Only, with you gone and the White Council having its hands full,
Murphy shook her head.
God,
even the Vanilla News is starting to notice the weirdness in town.
So, Molly wouldn't stay with anyone. She's always moving. But she got it into her head that Chicago didn't need an actual White Council wizard to help calm things down. The bad guys just had to think one was here. So she started posting messages whenever she dealt with some wandering predator, and called herself the Ragged Lady, declaring Chicago protected territory.
That's crazy, I said. What part of she isn't right didn't you understand? Murphy replied to Morty, her voice sharp. She took a breath and calmed herself again.
The craziest part is that it worked.
At least partly. A lot of bad things have decided to play elsewhere. College towns out in the country are the worst. But things have happened here. She shivered. Violent things. Mostly to the bad guys, but sometimes to humans. Gangers, mostly. The Ragged Lady's calling card is a piece of cloth she tears off and leaves on her enemies. And there are lots and lots of pieces of cloth being found these days. A lot of them on corpses. I swallowed.
You think it's Molly?
We don't know, Murphy replied in her professionally neutral voice. Molly says she isn't going after anything but the supernatural threats, and I've got no reason to disbelieve her, but Murphy showed her hands. So when you said Raggedy Ann, I said, you meant Molly.
She's like this battered, stained, torn-up doll, Murphy said. Believe me, it fits.
Battered, torn-up, scary doll, Will said quietly. And you just let her be that way? I demanded. Murphy ground her teeth.
No. I talked to her half a dozen times. We tried an intervention to get her off the street.
We shouldn't have, Will said.
What happened? Mort asked.
Will apparently assumed it had been my question. She hammered us like a row of nails on balsa wood is what happened, he said. Lights, sound, images.
Jesus, I've got a picture in my head of being dragged off into the never-never by monsters that I still can't get rid of.
When she gave it to me, all I could do was curl up into a ball and scream.
Will's description made me feel sick to my stomach,
which was ridiculous because it wasn't like I ate food anymore, but my innards hadn't gotten the memo. I looked away, grimacing, tasting bitter bile in my mouth.
Memories are weapons, Sir Stuart said quietly. Sharp as knives.
Murphy held up her hand to cut Will off.
Whether or not she's going too far, she's the only one we have with a major league talent.
Not that the Ordo hasn't done well by us, Abby, she added, nodding toward the blonde woman.
Not at all, Abby replied, undisturbed. We aren't all made the same size and shape, are we?
Abby looked at me more or less and said,
We built the wards around Karen's house. 300 people from the Paranet, all working together.
She put a hand on an exterior wall where the power of the patchwork ward hummed steadily.
Took us less than a day.
And 200 pizzas, Murphy muttered, and a citation.
And well worth it,
Abby said, arching an eyebrow that dared Murphy to disagree. Murphy shook her head, but I could see her holding off a smile. The point is, we're waiting for Molly to confirm your bona fides, Harry.
Morty said. Is that safe, Ms. Murphy? If the girl was his apprentice, won't her reaction to his shade likely be somewhat emotional?
Will snorted. The way nitroglycerin is somewhat volatile. He took a breath and then said, Karen, are you sure about this? Murphy looked around the room slowly. Abby's eyes were on the floor, but her usually rosy cheeks were pale, and Toto's ears drooped unhappily. Will's expression was steady, but his body language was that of a man who thinks he might need to dive through a closed window at any second. Forthill was watching the room at large, exuding calm confidence, but his brow was furrowed, and the set of his mouth was slightly tense. With the exception of Forthill, I'd seen them all react to direct danger. They were all scared of Molly. Murphy faced them. She was the smallest person in the room. Her expression was as smooth and expressive as a sheet of ice, her body posture steady. She looked as though she felt she was ready for just about anything. But I've been in more than one furball with Murph, and I saw through her outer shell to the fear that was driving her. She didn't know if I was real. For all she knew, I might be some kind of boogeyman from the nightmare side of the street, and that was unacceptable. She had to know. The problem was that no matter what answer she got, it was going to hurt. If Molly pegged me as a bad guy, the knowledge that the real Harry Dresden was still missing and presumed dead after the flash of contact Mort had provided would be like a frozen blade in the guts. And if she learned that it really was my shade, it would be even worse. Molly will be fine, Murphy said. We need her. She'll come through. She passed her hand over her brush of hair. Her voice turned into something much smaller, weighed down by pain. No offense to Mr. Lindquist, no offense to Mister, but we have to know. Paranoid? Probably. But just because you're paranoid doesn't mean there isn't a wizard's ghost standing beside you, with tears in his eyes. Chapter 11 Not long after, something scratched at the front door, and Will opened it to admit a gray-brown-furred wolf. The wolf trotted over to where Marcy's dress lay folded on the sofa, took it in her teeth, and vanished into the kitchen. Marcy appeared a few seconds later, settling the dress around her slender form, and said, She'll be here any moment. I already told Andy and Eyes. Thank you, Marcy. Murph looked at everyone and said, Settle down, people. You look like you're expecting Hannibal Lecter to come through the door. I could handle Hannibal, Will said. This is different.
Murphy put a fist on her hip and said, Will, Molly is one of us, and you aren't going to help her by looking nervous. If you can't settle down and relax, get out of here. I don't want you upsetting her.
Will grimaced. Then he went into the kitchen, and a moment later, a large wolf with fur the same color as Will's hair padded back into the room. He went to a corner, turned around three times, and settled down on the floor. Toto let out a sharp little bark of greeting and hopped down to hurry over to Will. The little dog sniffed Will, then turned around three times and settled down next to him, their backs touching. The big wolf took a deep breath and exhaled it into a very human-sounding sigh of resignation. Thank you, Murphy said. She glanced at Mort.
There's a circle made out of copper wire in the kitchen. If it gets hot in here, you can run for it. You know how to empower a circle?
Yes, of course, he licked his lips and said. Though I can't imagine running for my life and stopping in the kitchen, meaning no offense to your protective ability, but I'll stop when I'm home, thank you.
God, Murphy said. If only more people had as much sense as you. Murphy's radio chirped and eyes started to say something. His voice drowned an instant later in a burst of static. That ratcheted more tension in everyone. Wizards and their major magical talent are tough on hardware. The more complex a machine is, the more disruptive a wizard's presence becomes, and electronics are nearly always the first to malfunction when a wizard is nearby. The wonky radio warned us of Molly's approach every bit as clearly as a sentry shouting, "Who goes there?"
"Huh," I said. Mort glanced at me.
"What?"
"The technology disruption a practitioner causes is relative to his, or her, strength."
"I knew that, actually," Mort said. "It's why I have to keep replacing my cell phone. So?"
So Molly was not a heavyweight in terms of raw power. She had to be practically close enough to touch something to hex it down that fast. I narrowed my eyes. "She's gotten stronger." "Either that or..."
"She's already in the room," Mort said. Murphy looked up sharply at that.
"What?"
The house lights flickered for a second, and then went out. They weren't gone long, the space of a heartbeat or two. But when they came back up, Murphy had her gun in hand. Marcy had become a wolf with a sundress hanging around her neck, and a young woman, wrapped in layers and layers of cast-off clothing, sat on the sofa between Abby and Mort, not 6 inches away from either of them. Molly was tall and built like a pin-up model, with long, long legs and curves that not even the layers of clothing could hide. Her face was lovely and devoid of makeup, and her cheekbones pressed out harshly against her skin. Her hair was dirty, stringy, tangled, and colored the shade of purple so dark as to be nearly indistinguishable from black. A wooden cane stained the same color of deep purple leaned against her knees, and an old military-issue canvas knapsack covered with buttons and drawings and magic marker rested between her hiking boots. From Abby's and Mort's reactions, it must have smelled like it had been at least several days since her last shower. But it was her eyes that were the worst. My apprentice's blue eyes were sunken, surrounded by shadows of stress and fatigue, and an odd light glittered there in the glassy shine I'd seen mostly in people recovering from anesthesia. "It's interesting that you would notice me," Molly said to Mort, as if she'd been politely participating in the conversation all along.
The ectomancer twitched, and I saw him fight off the desire to get up and sprint for his car.
Molly nodded and looked around the rest of the room, person by person, until she got to Murphy.
"I hope we're planning a civil discussion this time, Karen."
Murph put her gun away, giving Molly a mild glance by way of reprimand.
"We were being civil last time. We're your friends, Molly, and we are worried about you."
My apprentice shrugged.
"I don't want anyone like friends anywhere near me. If you include yourself among them, you should leave me the hell alone."
Her voice had turned into a snarl by the end of the sentence, and she paused to take a slow, deliberate breath and calm down.
"I don't have the patience or the time for a group therapy session. What do you want?"
Murphy seemed to consider her answer for a moment. She wound up going for brevity.
"We need you to verify something for us."
"Do I look like a fact-checker to you, Karen?"
"You look like a homeless scarecrow," Murphy said, her tone matter-of-fact. "You smell like a gutter."
"I thought you used to be a detective," Molly said, rolling her eyes. "See above, regarding not wanting anyone around me? It's not all that hard to understand."
"Miss Carpenter," said Father Forthill in a sudden tone of gentle authority, "you are a guest in this woman's home, a woman who has put her own life in danger to save others, including you." Molly turned an absolutely arctic look onto Father Forthill. Then she said in a quiet, flat monotone, "I don't particularly care to be spoken to as if I am still a child, Father. If you wish to be respected as an adult, you should comport yourself as one," Forthill replied, "which includes behaving with civility toward your peers and respect toward your elders." Molly glowered for a moment more, but then turned back to Murphy. "All things considered, it's stupid for me to be here. And I'm a busy woman, Miss Murphy. Nothing but customers, customers, customers. So I'm out the door in 5 seconds unless you give me a good reason to stay." "This is Mort Lindquist, ectomancer," Murphy said promptly. "He says he's here to speak to us on behalf of Harry's ghost. Who is with him?" Molly absolutely froze in place, her face blanched beneath the grime. "I'd like it if you could verify for us whether or not it's true," Murphy said, her voice gentle. "I need to know if it's really his ghost." Molly stared at her for a second, then shivered and looked down at her hands. Murphy leaned a little closer to Molly. "You could tell, couldn't you?" Molly shot her a wide-eyed glance and looked down again. She muttered something before she said, "Yes, but not with so many people in the room."
"Why not?"
Molly's voice turned into a bitter snarl.
"Do you want my help or not?"
Murphy folded her arms for a long moment. Then she said, "Time for another stroll in the evening air, people. Mr. Lindquist, please stay. Everyone else, out." Mort was trying very hard not to look like a man who wanted to run for the door and getting mixed results.
Of course, Ms. Murphy."
Murphy had to urge the werewolves to leave and help Marcy get untangled from her dress. Forthill and Abby looked at each other and left the room without a murmur. Molly sat completely still during this, staring down at her folded hands.
"You don't have clue one, do you?" she asked Murphy quietly. "You don't have any idea what you're asking me to go through. If I could do it myself, I would."
Molly looked up sharply at that. Her smile was unpleasant, bordering on creepy.
"Easy words," she said. "Easy words. They leave little trails of slime on your lips when they pass them. But it doesn't make them go down any more smoothly."
"Molly,"
Murphy sighed and sat down and spread her hands,
"you won't let us help you. You won't talk to us. But this is something I literally cannot ask of anyone else."
"You always asked him,"
Molly said, her tone spiteful.
"There's a boiler about to burst," Sir Stuart murmured to me.
"Shut your mouth," I said quietly, coming automatically to her defense. But he was right. The kid was teetering on a cliff as I sat there looking at her. I stared at Molly and I felt absolutely wretched. She was my apprentice. I was supposed to have taught her to survive without me. Granted, I hadn't planned on taking a bullet in the chest, but then who does? Or was her condition simply symptomatic of the world she lived in? Murphy regarded the younger woman for a long moment and then nodded.
"Yes. I know enough to know when I'm out of my depth. My instincts say Mort isn't trying to con me, but we've got to have more than just my intuition. I need your help, please."
Molly shook her head very slowly, shivering. She wiped at her face with her grimy gloves, and clean streaks appeared on her cheeks.
"Fine."
She lifted her head, looked at Mort, and said calmly, "If you're running a con, I will peel the skin off your brain." The ectomancer spread his hands.
"Look, Dresden Shade came to me. If it isn't him, that ain't my fault. I'm operating in good faith here."
"You're a roach," Molly said pleasantly. "Runs and hides from any threat, but you survive, don't you?"
"Yes,"
Mort said frankly.
"Maybe I should have been a roach too," Molly said. "It would be easier."
She took a slow, deep breath and said,
"Where is he?"
Mort pointed a finger at me. I took a few steps until I stood in the mouth of the hallway that led down to Murphy's bedrooms. I gestured to Sir Stuart to stay back.
Why? He asked. She's going to use her sight. The less she has to look at, the better.
Sir Stuart shrugged and stayed near Mort. He watched Molly through narrowed eyes, his fingertips on the handle of that monster pistol. Molly grabbed her cane and rose to her feet, leaning on it, taking the weight off the leg that had been shot at Chichen Itza. She straightened her back and shoulders, turned toward me, took a deep breath, and opened her sight.
I'd never seen such a thing from this angle before. It was as if a sudden light, burning steadily and unwavering, kindled just between and above her eyebrows. As it flooded out of her, I felt it as a tangible sensation on my immaterial flesh. It was blinding. I lifted a hand for a moment to shield my eyes against it before I looked up to meet Molly's gaze. Her lips parted. She stared at me, and tears blurred her vision.
She tried twice to speak before she said, "How do I know it's you?" I could answer her. It's called the sight, but it embraces the entire spectrum of human perception, and then some. I met her gaze and composed my face. Then I said, in my very best Alec Guinness impersonation, "You will go to the Dagobah system. There you will learn from Yoda, the Jedi Master who instructed me."
Molly sat down abruptly, missed the couch, and hit the floor instead.
"Oh, my God," she breathed. "Oh, my God, oh, my God, oh, my God. Harry." I knelt to be on eye level with her.
"Yeah, kid, it's me."
Are you really, really gone?"
I shrugged. "I don't know. I guess I am. I'm sort of new at this, and they aren't in danger of winning any exposition awards around here."
She nodded as more tears came, but she didn't look away.
"Did you come to take me away?"
she asked, her voice very small.
"No," I said quietly.
"Molly, no. I was sent back here."
Why?
She whispered. "To find my murderer," I said quietly. "People I care about are in danger if I don't get the job done."
Molly began rocking back and forth where she sat.
I've been trying. The city has become so dark, and I knew what you would expect of me. But I'm not as strong as you. I can't just smash things like you could."
"Molly," I said in a calm, clear tone.
Her reddened, exhausted blue eyes looked up at me. "You know who I want to know about, don't you? Who I wouldn't want you to talk about in front of anyone." I hadn't said my daughter's name since returning to Chicago. Hell, I barely dared to think it. As far as the rest of the world knew, Maggie had been engulfed in the conflagration that devoured the Red Court. Anyone who knew of her identity might well hold it against her. I didn't want that. Not if I wasn't going to be there to protect her. My throat felt tight because I thought it should, I suppose.
"You know who I'm asking about?"
"Yes," she said. "Of course."
"Is that person safe and well?"
"As far as I know, yes," she said.
A small smile made her for an instant resemble the girl I remembered.
"Chewbacca is with her."
There was only one giant walking carpet to whom she could be referring. My dog, Mouse. The beast was smarter than a lot of people, and was probably the single best supernatural guardian any child could have had. And he was huge and warm and fuzzy and perfectly content to be a blanket or pillow, or a furious incarnation of preternatural strength and speed, depending on which was needed at the moment. Hell, Maggie was only 8. He was probably spending half his time pretending to be a pony. I exhaled slowly and felt a little dizzy. The memories I had of Maggie, what few there were hammering their way across my consciousness. I mostly remembered holding her in the quiet after it was all over. I'm not sure how long I sat there with her. She had been a small, sleepy warmth in my arms, grateful for the comfort of being held. We can go see her, Molly suggested. I mean, I know where she is.
I wanted to shout an agreement and leap at the chance, but I couldn't, so I didn't. Maybe after we take care of business, I said.
All right, Molly said, nodding.
Better button up your sight, kid, I said quietly. There's no reason to leave it open so long. Bad things could happen.
But I won't be able to see you or hear you, which seems odd given that it's called the sight.
It encompasses a lot, I said loftily. Kid, you've got a gift. Trust your instincts.
Which, in this case, should suggest to you that what you need is the spirit-viewing ointment we made off of Rashid's fairy sight recipe, or something like it.
Okay, she said. Okay.
She frowned and bowed her head, and I saw her sight being withdrawn, the light at her forehead dwindling and finally winking out. Murphy was sitting at the very edge of her chair, her back straight, her hands in her lap.
Miss Carpenter?
Molly turned to look at Murphy. It seemed to take her a second or two to focus her eyes.
Yes? It's him?
He greeted me with a quote from The Empire Strikes Back. Murphy's mouth twitched at one corner. Him. My apprentice nodded and didn't meet Murphy's eyes.
So, Murphy said, he's really, really gone. That bullet killed him. He's gone, Molly said. The Shade is, it's hairy in every practical sense. It will have his memories, his personality. But it isn't him.
Molly shook her head.
I asked him about that once, about what happens to a soul when a ghost is left behind. What did he say? That he had no idea, and that he doubted anyone would ever get a straight answer. Molly, the older woman said, I know you're tired. I would like it if you let me offer you some clothes, a meal, a shower, some real sleep. My house is protected. I'd like to be able to tell your parents that I did at least that much for you the next time they call me to ask about you.
Molly looked around the room for a moment, biting her lip.
Yes, it, she shivered. But it's better if I don't.
Better for who?
Everyone, Molly said.
She gathered herself and rose, using the cane to get to her feet once again. She grimaced in the process. It was obvious that using her legs still caused her pain.
Honestly, I've been playing a lot of games, and I don't want any of them to splash onto you.
She paused and then said tentatively,
I'm sorry about the detective remark, Karen. That was going too far.
Murphy shrugged.
Least said, soonest mended.
My apprentice sighed and began pulling her tattered layers about herself a little more securely.
Mr. Lindquist appears to be working in good faith. I'll come back tomorrow with something that might let you communicate with Harry Shade a little more easily. Thank you, Murphy said. While you're at it, it might be smart to...
There was a sudden blaring of a pocket-sized air horn from outside. Mort hopped up from his seat into a crouch, ready either to run or to fling himself heroically to the floor.
What was that?
Trouble, Murphy said, unlimbering her gun.
Get di-
She hadn't finished speaking when gunfire roared outside and bullets began ripping through the windows and the walls. Chapter 12. I did what any sane person would do in a situation like that. I threw myself to the ground.
Oh, honestly, Dresden, Sir Stuart snapped.
He sprinted toward the gunfire out through the wall of the house. I actually saw the building's wards flare up with spectral blue-white light around him as he went through unimpeded.
Right, dummy, I growled at myself. You're already dead.
I got up and ran after the Elder Shade. The living were all kissing the hardwood floor as I plunged into the wall of the house. I wasn't worried about the wards keeping me in. No one ever designed their wards so that bad things couldn't leave, only so that they couldn't enter. Besides, I'd had an invitation to come in, which technically made me a friendly. But I found out that friendly wards operated on much the same principle as friendly fire.
Going out through the warded wall didn't just tingle unpleasantly. I felt like I just plunged naked down a water slide lined with steel wool.
Ow!
I screamed, emerging from the wards and onto Murphy's front lawn, chock full of new insight as to why ghosts are always moaning or wailing when they come popping out of somebody's wall or floor. Not much mystery there. It freaking hurts. I staggered for several steps and looked up in time to see the drive-by still in progress. They were in a pickup truck. Someone in the passenger's compartment had the barrel of a shotgun sticking out the window, and four figures in dark clothing crouched in the truck's cargo bed, pointing what looked like assault weapons and submachine guns at Murphy's house. They were cutting loose with them, too, flashes of thunder and lightning too bright and loud to be real, seemingly magnified by the quiet, still air between the snow and the streetlights. These guys weren't real pros. I'd seen true professional gunmen in action, and these jokers didn't look anything like them. They just pointed the business end more or less in a general direction and sprayed bullets. It wasn't the disciplined fire of true professionals, but if you throw out enough bullets, you're bound to hit something. Bullets went through me, half a dozen flashes of tingling discomfort, too brief to be more than an annoyance, and I suddenly found myself sprinting toward the truck beside Sir Stuart, exhilarated. Being bulletproof is kind of a rush.
"What are we doing?" I shouted at him. "I mean, what are we accomplishing here? We can't do anything to them, can we?" "Watch and learn, lad," Sir Stuart called, his teeth bared in a wolfish grin. "On three, be on the truck."
"What?"
"I think..." "Don't think," the Shade shouted. "Just do it. Let your instincts guide you. Be on the truck. One, two..."
The Shade's feet struck the ground hard twice, like a long jumper at the end of his approach. I followed Sir Stuart's example on little more than reflex. A sudden memory flashed into my head. A school playground from my childhood, where mock Olympic games were being run, students competing against one another. The sun was hot above us, making the petroleum smell of warm asphalt rise from the surface of the playground. I'd been competing in the running long jump, and it hadn't been going well. I forget exactly why I was so desperate to win, but I was fixated on it, as only a child could be. I remembered willing myself to win, to run faster, to jump farther, as I sprinted down the lane toward the pink chalk jump line. It was the first time I used magic. I had no idea at the time, naturally, but I remembered the feeling of utter elation that flooded through me, along with an invisible force that pushed against my back as I leapt, and for just an instant I thought I had spontaneously learned to fly like Superman. Reality reasserted itself in rapid order. I fell, out of control, my arms spinning like a windmill. I went down on the blacktop and left generous patches of skin on its surface. I remember how much it hurt, and how I didn't care, because I'd won. I broke the Iowa State High School long jump record by more than a foot. It didn't stick, though. They disqualified me. I hadn't even gotten serious about puberty yet. Clearly something irregular had happened, mistakes had been made, and surely the best thing was to ignore the anomalous leap. It was a vivid recollection, silly and a little sad, and it was my first time. It was a powerful memory.
"Three!"
Sir Stuart cried, and leapt. So did I, my eyes and will locked on the retreating pickup full of gunmen. There was a twisting, dizzying sensation that reminded me very strongly of a potion Bob had helped me mix up when I'd tangled with the Shadow Man. It was that same experience, a feeling of flying apart into zillions of pieces, rushing forward at a speed too great to be measured, only to abruptly coalesce again. There was a sudden cold wind against my face, and I staggered, nearly falling off the roof of the pickup as it continued to slowly accelerate down the street.
"Holy crap!"
I said as a huge smile stretched my face. "That was cool! First Shadowcat, now Nightcrawler!" I turned to find Sir Stuart standing on the bed of the truck, looking up at me with a disapproving eyebrow lifted. One of the shooter's backs was in the same space as the Shade's right leg. "Doesn't that hurt?" I asked him, nodding to his leg.
"Hmm,"
Sir Stuart said. He glanced down and saw what I was talking about.
"Oh, I suppose, yes. I stopped noticing it after 70 or 80 years. Now, if you don't mind, Dresden, might we proceed?
To do what? I asked.
To teach you what are obviously badly needed lessons, Sir Stewart said, and to stop these pirates.
He spat the last word with a startling amount of venom. I frowned and eyed the gunmen, who were all reloading, having emptied their weapons in sheer nervous excitement. They weren't particularly good at reloading, either.
Hell, one man with a handgun could take them all right now, I said. Too bad neither of us has one.
We cannot touch flesh, Sir Stewart said. And while it is possible for a shade to, for example, move an object, it is impractical. With practice, you could push a penny across a table over the course of a couple of minutes.
Too bad neither of us has a penny, I said.
He ignored me entirely.
That's because we can put forth only minuscule physical force. You couldn't lift a coin into the air against the pull of gravity.
I frowned. This sounded a lot like a basic lesson most young wizards received. Most of the time, when you wanted to move something around, you didn't have the kind of energy you needed stored inside you. That didn't mean you couldn't move it, though. It just meant you had to get the energy to do so from another source.
But you can co-opt energy from elsewhere.
The big man pointed an index finger at me, a smile stretching his mouth.
Excellent. We cannot interact with something being moved by a living creature. We can't even touch an object that is being carried too closely to a living body. But,
he glanced up at me, inviting me to finish the thought. I blinked twice, mind racing, and said,
Machines. We can work with machines.
Sir Stewart nodded. As long as they are in motion.
And there is an enormous amount of energy in motion passing through a non-living mechanical engine.
Without another word, he paced forward through the back wall of the cab, sat on the passenger's seat, and leaned to his left. I couldn't see what he was doing, so I dropped to all fours, took a deep breath, and stuck my face through the roof of the cab. It tingled and hurt, but I had literally spent a lifetime learning to cope with pain. I pushed it to the back of my mind, gritted my teeth, and watched. Sir Stewart had pushed his hand into the steering wheel of the truck. He pushed the other forward, leaning partly through the dashboard to do it, and waited patiently, watching the road ahead of us. It didn't take long for the truck to hit a hummock in the ice coating the streets, and the truck bounced, shocks squealing. Just as it did, the shade's eyes fluttered closed, and he gave a peculiar jerking twist of his arm. The truck's airbag exploded out of the steering wheel. It struck the driver, smacking him back into the driver's seat, and the man panicked. His arms tightened in surprise as he was hit, and he turned the steering wheel several degrees to one side. Then he broke the cardinal rule of driving on ice and stomped his foot on the brake. The slight turn and the sudden braking motion put the car into a slide. The driver was trying to push the airbag out of his face, and he didn't compensate and turn into the slide. The slide became a spin. Sir Stewart watched in satisfaction, looked up at me, and said, Not much different from spooking a horse, really. The gunmen in the back were screaming in confusion as the car spun through three ponderous circles, somehow putting forth the illusion of grace. They bounced off the snow, piled high on one side of the street, and then slid into an intersection, up over a sidewalk, and through the front windows of a small grocery store. The sounds of shattering glass and brick, screaming metal crumpling through its zones and cracking snow and ice were shockingly loud. The steadily ringing bell of the store's security alarm sounded like my old Mickey Mouse alarm clock in comparison. The gunman sat there doing nothing for a moment, clearly stunned, but then they began cursing and scrambling to get gone before the cops showed up. Sir Stewart vanished and reappeared across the street. I made the same effort of will I had while jumping to the truck, reaching back for that memory once more. Again, I flew apart and came back together, reappearing, standing next to Sir Stewart, facing a brick wall. Next time, turn around on the way, he advised. I snorted and looked back at the gunman.
What about them?
What about them?
Can't we, I don't know, possess them and make them bang their heads into a wall or something?
Sir Stewart barked out a harsh laugh.
We cannot enter unless the mortal is willing. That is the purview of demons, not shades.
I scowled.
So what? We stand here and watch them walk? He shrugged.
I'm not willing to leave Mortimer alone for so much time. You may also wish to consider, Dresden,